Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's say it's a fine February night. You're thinking you want to make good on that New Year's resolution to be a better friend. Spend less time on social media, more time making connections IRL. You're going to talk more with your friends. You're going to call them more. So you pop in your earbuds, scroll through those contacts, you hit call, and the conversation is going well. Then, all of a sudden, outage.
New this morning, T-Mobile users across the U.S. experienced service outages overnight. The cellular tracking website downdetector.com tracked more than 80,000 outages. Users say their service changed to SOS mode, meaning they were not directly connected to a network but could still make emergency calls.
That was from February of this year, when T-Mobile suffered a nationwide cell phone outage, cutting off service to more than 80,000 customers. Quote, "Our teams are rapidly addressing a third-party fiber interruption issue that has intermittently impacted some voice, messaging, and data services in several areas," end quote. That was from T-Mobile's president of technology, Neville Ray, who tweeted after the incident. He added, "The situation is improving, and we hope to have a full resolution very soon. We apologize for any disruption caused." As to what caused the disruption, no specific cause was identified. Now, we're not picking on T-Mobile alone. We're saying that an SOS call needs to go out for all of the nation's cell phone networks. Because a quick perusal of local television reports over the past couple of years easily produces this.
If you're having trouble making calls on your cell phone today, you are not alone. A major outage is affecting Verizon customers nationwide, mostly here on the West Coast.
And this.
AT&T says it's experiencing a major outage across South Florida and other parts of the state right now. Downdetector.com reports more than 16,000 people reported outages on AT&T as of 5 this afternoon. So far, no word on the cause or how long it could last.
Now, finding these examples is unfortunately very easy. Fish in the cliched barrel. But as more Americans rely exclusively on mobile networks for almost all of their communication needs, personal, work, emergencies, can the nation's various mobile networks consistently provide the kind of reliability the country needs? What makes the U.S. different from, say, South Korea? Famed for its ultra-fast and highly reliable mobile infrastructure. That's what we're going to talk about today, and we also definitely want to hear from you. So what do you think of your mobile carrier's reliability? Hop on social media, Facebook or Twitter, and find us at On Point Radio and let us know. Well, joining us today is Harold Feld. He is the Senior Vice President for Public Knowledge, a consumer advocacy organization working at the intersection of copyright, telecommunications issues, and the internet. He was also previously on the FCC's Communication Security, Reliability, and Interoperability Council. Harold, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, Harold, can the United States ever have the dreamy, reliable, high-speed, total coverage that, say, South Korea has?
Well, yes, we can. And in fact, back when we had just a wireline network, we did. What has happened is that when the cell phone network started up, the FCC and Congress were essentially, well, this is a new technology. We don't want to regulate it out of existence, let it grow. And we've got the regular telephone network for reliability. But as we've replaced the regular telephone network with the wireless network, we haven't stopped and said, well, okay, the wireless network is now the primary network. We need to go back to making sure that it's reliable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's really fascinating to note that we're actually having this conversation on quite a landmark week, because I believe on Monday, this Monday, it was the 50th anniversary, the 50-year mark of the first cell phone call made. So we have come a very, very long way in that time from the age of the, you know, like the hand, oh, yeah. You had to hold it with two hands almost, right? Like the brick that was literally pressed to your ear and you had to be in the line of sight of whatever in order to use any kind of mobile communication. So I want to note that because technology does advance rapidly. And the question is not just the handset technology, but now we're talking about the infrastructure that supports it. So, Harold, you know, before we get into the question of how to make it more reliable, I wonder if we could actually step back and can you give us sort of the mobile network 101? Because I want to understand how the system currently works. So, first of all, like the cell towers, the mobile towers, who actually owns those?
Right. So there's two pieces here. There's for a wireless network, there's wireless and then the underlying network. So the wireless piece, the piece from your phone to the tower, this industry has evolved a lot. We now have a lot of towers are owned by companies that specialize in just building and owning the towers, folks like American Tower and a number of other companies. And the cell phone companies lease space on these towers. So the cell phone companies then own the receiving antennas. You think of the, you know, kind of that big giant metal thing as just like a giant antenna. It's actually made of these very sophisticated tiny antennas that are designed to share the capacity and catch the phone calls in ways that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago, let alone 50 years ago.
Okay, so I'm just trying to envision what, you know, a tower I might see driving down the road looks like. There's the actual tower itself and then all the like little antennas, and each one of those might belong to a different carrier.
Right. You have, you know, basically, if you look, you see what look like these kind of rectangular blocks on the towers. Each one of those is what we call a phased array. And they use something called MIMO, which is a massive technology that gives you massive antenna efficiency to give you a tremendous amount of capacity.
Okay, so that explains the sort of fixed points of the towers in the network, and then of course there's the radio spectrum on which the communication is happening from device to tower and then from tower to tower, right? So that, I mean, that's a whole major part of the picture here.
Yeah, it's primarily in urban areas, it's primarily from your phone to the tower. What's called wireless backhaul between towers in some situations, but really what you want is for the tower to connect to a fiber line and push it back into the network. But the radio spectrum is the piece that the wireless companies like to focus on because that's something where they can say if there are problems, it's not their fault.
Okay. So let me just pause you there, because if that's what they like to focus on, we're going to wait and focus on the parts that they don't necessarily want us to focus on. So you mentioned something that I hadn't thought about. So you want the towers to be connected to a fiber line. Okay. So in situations where that is indeed the case, who owns the fiber lines?
And here again, we can see one of the great things about the technology, it is allows you to break these things up into little pieces, which increase the efficiency and make things cheaper to run. But at the same time, it also makes things much more complicated and more things can go wrong. So sometimes it's one of the companies like AT&T or Verizon that owns that fiber line. Sometimes it's an independent company that owns that fiber line. And that fiber line goes back and connects to some sort of network operating center, which itself may be owned by a different company, which routes that call so that it can go to the proper location of a tower that is closest to the phone it's trying to connect to. And then that array on that tower sends the call to the receiving phone. And along the way here, there are a number of different companies that are responsible for just looking up where the right phone number, where that phone number can be found, making sure that the call gets routed properly, and trying to ensure that the quality of the sound remains consistent enough for people to be able to hear each other when they do connect.
Okay, so just to put it at the level of a typical mobile customer's understanding, typical being me in this case. So I have I've got my phone, I've got my carrier to whom I pay the bill. Okay, in my case, like let's use Verizon as an example. But what you're saying is that Verizon probably owns the specific array on any particular tower that my cell phone is communicating with. The tower is owned by someone else. Does that mean that like the particular fiber that array might be connected to may or may not be owned by Verizon?
That's right. Now, it happens that Verizon is one of the companies that owns a lot of these fiber lines, at least in the areas where they traditionally offered telephone service. In areas where they didn't traditionally offer telephone service, because the telephone services kind of grew to be a big part of this fiber network in their area of service. But outside of that, they also have to lease capacity from other companies.
Okay. And then, as you said, going sort of further downstream here, there's the big relay centers, which all sorts of companies might be involved in. And then there's the companies that help figure out sort of how to most efficiently use the spectrum space to make calls clear. So lots of different players here in a system, which, Harold, as you're saying, ideally should make it more dynamic and reliable. But sometimes we find ourselves in a situation where that is not the case. So when we come back, we're going to talk about what are the things that can cause what seem to be frequent unreliability in America's mobile networks. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand why America's mobile networks seem to have a major reliability problem. And I'm joined today by Harold Feld. He's Senior Vice President for Public Knowledge. It's a consumer advocacy organization that works on copyright, telecom, and the internet. And he used to be on the FCC's Communications Security Reliability and Interoperability Council. So, Harold, look, I'm about to ask you perhaps an impossible to answer question, and that is what causes these, you know, the unreliability that many people experience in this country. I know it's probably a lot of different things, given the complexity of the system you described to us previously. But are there a couple of causes that come up more than others?
Yeah, and just one little correction I have to make, Meghna. I am still on the CISRIC, and so I ought to clarify that nothing I say here is in any way representative of the CISRIC or any position of the CISRIC or of the FCC, even though I don't work for the FCC. But just to make that point, there are a couple of things.
Hang on, Harold, just so I'm clear. So you're on the Security Reliability and Interoperability Council, but you are not an employee of the FCC. Is that correct?
It's a federal advisory commission. Yeah.
Understood. Okay. And I apologize for my error, but go ahead.
So breaking it down, we've got a couple of places where we see problems. For the kind of outages you were talking about at the beginning of the show, as T-Mobile had or Verizon and AT&T have had, those tend to be problems in the network, where the issue is that the network is very complicated. Something goes wrong. The company doesn't even know what went wrong. It could be something that they control. It might be something that one of their contractors control. This is why these outages frequently go across multiple states, but not in any way that looks rational to people. It's like 38 states, but different areas of different states. Well, that's because a server didn't flip at the right time, and it caused an overload that cascaded through the system. And it takes hours, sometimes days, to find out where the problem occurred as the company is trying to route around it. The other issues that come up, particularly in rural areas, are companies just don't build out enough towers. Towers are expensive to build, and in rural areas, you have to cover a much larger geographic area for many fewer customers. So you will see this a lot in rural America, even places that we don't think of as rural, but where the population density is comparatively low. You have lousy reception all the time and outages occurring frequently because the companies don't want to spend the money to extend the network out that far. And finally, you have sometimes problems with capacity. This generally doesn't happen. Phone companies are pretty good at trying to handle this, but particularly in crowded urban areas, it's not a question of the towers. We have enough towers generally in urban areas, but it's a question of so many people are trying to use the same pieces of the spectrum, the public airwaves, at the same time, that it makes it difficult to share that capacity among all the users. So it gets more congested. You have to play more technical tricks to make it happen. And so the quality of the phone and the call can become very problematic. You get dropped calls. You know, you were going fine, and then suddenly things drop. Well, sometimes that's because you wandered in front of a steel beam and the signal just drops. But sometimes it's because the company is trying to share these little antennas on the array with hundreds of thousands of phones trying to connect it at once, and yours got dropped out of there.
Yeah. You know, as much as I hate to do this, I want to be fair to the carriers, right? And in fact, all the companies that are part of the mobile networks in the United States, because the outages are a problem. Obviously, we're doing a show about it, but also what they accomplish on a day-to-day basis is kind of amazing. I mean, just yesterday, I was on a WhatsApp call with a relative in Australia. The call quality was pretty good, and there was like basically no delay. I mean, I was calling effortlessly. Not even calling, right? It was an app-based call. Someone in Australia. And so, I mean, is there an argument to be made that part of the problem is also that the technology in our hands regarding the things that the devices can do is always going to be out in front of what the network is capable of doing? And so these carriers are constantly playing catch-up, meaning we're just going to have to kind of live with a certain amount of unreliability as a sheer fact of how the technology is developed?
See, I don't think that's a good argument for voice. And keep in mind that we generally treat the voice part of the call separately from the internet part of the call for a number of reasons. And with voice, where I see the problems are the strengths are also the weaknesses. That is to say, the fact that you can break this up into a lot of different pieces so that you have competition and innovation at each stage is an enormous strength, but it's also a weakness because no single person, even the company that is offering you the service, is responsible for making sure that it all works together reliably all the time. It's kind of generally everyone's responsibility to make sure their piece is running. And when something is generally everybody's responsibility, it's nobody's actual responsibility.
Right. But when we have one entity that's responsible for a lot of things, we kind of look at that askance as monopoly. I mean, the telecommunications industry is a perfect example of how we have broken up monopolies in the past.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the challenge. And that's where we need to have smart strategies that look at the strengths that we have, you know, the network redundancy, the new information. Because back in the old Ma Bell days, you know, if you had a break in your phone line, that was just it. There was nothing you could do about it. Here, if, you know, let's say after a natural disaster and you have one carrier that manages to be up and running while the other carriers suffered enough damage that they're out, you can have what we call roaming agreements where everybody else can share capacity on the working carrier. So you don't have to rely on just one network in this kind of situation. You can rely on all the networks in this kind of situation to balance each other out. And that's how we have new thinking, new ways to take advantage of the new technologies to achieve that same result of reliability. But in fairness to the mobile phone industry, there is something of a trade-off. We can certainly do better, but I will say we're probably never going to go back to that 99.999% reliable that we expected out of the old monopoly telephone system.
Okay, so this is a really good point because, Harold, I will admit that I am old enough to remember when I did not have a mobile phone and just had my landline, but it was the one utility, essentially, that we could rely on to work almost no matter what happened around us, power failures, natural disasters, et cetera. That era is gone, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and there are a number of reasons why. I mean, for one thing, the old network was the old telephone network was self-powered. It was a copper line. It worked with an independent, the phone company provided independent power for it. So even if the power went out in your home, your landline still worked. Today, most landlines, unless you have one of the older copper lines, modern landlines are not capable of being self-powered. That's just the nature of the technology. But again, we can do better. One of the things we have talked about in the wireless industry is should you mandate backup power? You know, so that when the power goes out, you actually have a certain amount of backup power generators that are there at the tower, not something you bring in after the back out. Should there be, mandatory backup power in the underlying wireline network, those fiber lines that take the calls from the tower? So, you know, again, we're never going to go back to when it was a much simpler network that, you know, you could pound it and do lots of things and it would still operate. And it costs $10 every 5 minutes for a long distance call. That's how we paid for that reliability. So, because again, there's a cost trade-off. I mean, one of the things is, you know, while we look at I look at my phone bill every month and I go, what happened there? How is that so high? But I'm getting a lot more services out of it and a lot more hidden fees, but that's a different problem. But, you know, the fact is that under the old phone system, we had very high long-distance charges as the way of subsidizing a number of things, including that reliability. So, again, it's trade-offs, and we have to be smart about how we do it.
You know, the $10 a minute mention that you made, Harold. I'm sorry, I smiled there because it just all of a sudden like popped up into my head memories from when I was a kid. Obviously, my family hails from India to begin with, and we would almost never call my relatives in India because of that cost. And when we did, we'd like have to yell into the phone, and you could hear the echo and the static of it like bouncing off a satellite somewhere. And then it takes a while, like you could like watch it on your clock when the relative actually heard the message and back and forth. But I'm glad that we're not in those days anymore. But I do wonder what you think, Harold, about, you mentioned the size of the United States, the cost of putting mobile network infrastructure in rural areas, et cetera, as the company saying being prohibitive. But I wonder, honestly, How would you compare what the average American has accessible to them regarding mobile networks in this country to other nations? I mean, are we worse off, or are we actually better off and just like to complain about it?
It depends on what dimension we're talking about and also where you are. Look, the fact is that if you look at, international comparisons with other industrialized nations, we're pretty expensive for the service that we get. Our reliability, is good, but not super great. Now, sometimes those comparisons aren't, fair. South Korea is a much smaller, more compact, country, but it also depends a lot on the policies you adopt. Europe adopted a number of policies that increased competition there enormously. So their mobile rates are just much, much lower than ours, without suffering from, reliability problems. It is certainly the case that the United States remains a leader in the functions that we put into the phone, the capacities that we put into it, we are generally the first country to adopt a new generational technology. We're the first, company that was actively deploying, switching from 3G to 4G and then 4G to 5G. That has been our set of policy choices.
Okay, so it's finally time to talk about the spectrum, the thing that the mobile companies want us to look at.
Right. Which is part of the policy choices, exactly.
Yeah. So go ahead, tell us, what do we need to understand about the role that the area of the spectrum that companies have access to and the role that plays in reliability?
Okay, I'm going to start by saying, I do a little training on this every year for our incoming interns, and I'm going to say the same thing I say there. One, this is a gross oversimplification.
Okay.
So the other is, don't worry about what these numbers mean. A lot of times they're, just sort of arbitrary, and you just have to know that, certain frequency bands are better for certain things, and don't worry about what's the difference between 1 gigahertz and 3 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz, and just accept they're going to be a little different from each other for different reasons, and it would take an hour to get into the physics. So what we look at is, because what cell phone companies do is they want exclusive rights to use a particular block of spectrum in a particular geographic area. That's called a spectrum license, and you get it from the Federal Communications Commission. Wi-Fi is an example of where everybody gets to use the same block of spectrum, and it does what we call spectrum reuse, and you just accept what interference happens. We use exclusive licensing in order to try to avoid some of the interference issues. The consequence of that is, number one, it limits the number of providers you can have in a geographic area, because in order to have decent capacity, you can only have a couple of these licenses on the same set of frequencies. The other thing it does is mean that the customers for that company are only using the piece of the spectrum that is available to that company through its license. Otherwise, you have to do what's called roaming. You may see that, on your phone, you've entered into roaming. Those are expensive agreements between cell phone companies of, when I don't have the capacity, I rent it from you, essentially, and only where you have spare capacity, because your customers come first. So
yeah.
Whenever we add new functions and new users, you need more of that wireless capacity. And not only that, it has to be the right kind of capacity. For a long time, what you wanted was what was called low band spectrum, which was between 500 megahertz and 1 gigahertz. And there wasn't a lot of that. It was shared by a lot of other services like television. You may remember when we switched from traditional analog television to digital television. Part of the reason we did that was to squish the broadcasters down into a smaller amount of spectrum and take back spectrum that they used to use and auction it off to the phone companies so that we could go to 4G. As the technology's changed, we've started to move up the scale, and now we're talking about spectrum that's largely held by the federal government.
Oh, okay. Right. And specifically the Defense Department, right?
Defense Department has a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So when we come back, we're going to talk more about sort of the pressures on the spectrum and the role that the government can play. And we'll also take a look at what the companies say they offer versus what reality is on the ground. So that'll all be in just a minute. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why America's mobile networks seem to have a lot of reliability issues and how to make them meet the standards that we all probably have for a mobile 21st century. And we're getting some comments here online. John Baker says, I'd say not being a customer of T-Mobile or AT&T would be a good start, LOL. Ha ha, John. But we're also talking about Verizon and all the other companies having essentially the same basket of problems. But your point taken. I like that On Point listeners might have a sense of humor here. Now, as Harold Fell just described to us, we're trying to understand sort of the role that this spectrum plays in terms of producing a network or helping create a network that can meet the needs and the demands of a mobile nation here. So we talked about the government being able to apportion out parts of the spectrum. So really, we're focusing on the Department of Defense because they are a major holder of the radio spectrum. So back in 2014, there was a conversation between federal officials and telecommunications executives. And in that conversation, General Robert Wheeler explained that the spectrum, in the eyes of the Pentagon, is the thread that ties the different services of America's defense together, from space to planet Earth. And he gave an example of what that looks like for him.
In a combat or non-combat situation, I have a connection to the satellites continuously. I have data coming into that. I actually have a laptop that sits between me that has Microsoft Office on it. And so I get emails and things of that particular nature on there. At the same time, I've got Link 16 going up there showing all the other aircraft and all the other potential threats that are out there on my particular screen. At the same time, I'm getting voice. All of that's occurring at the same time. So I'm receiving data on two separate screens. I'm also receiving voice, multiple in most cases. Some of it's coming from satellites, coming from terrestrial-based. And then at the same time, I'm also starting to get a little pieces and parts of non-voice type thing, beeps and squeaks and things that come through that I understand that tell me where the threats are.
So that's General Robert Wheeler back in 2014 saying the Pentagon needs all that part of the spectrum. Well, telecommunications companies would say, we need it too because of the 330 million Americans that have some certain expectations for what they can be able to do with their mobile devices. So here's Meredith Atwell-Baker, CEO of CTIA. It's an industry trade group that represents the wireless industry. AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, et cetera. And last August, at a Senate hearing, Baker argued that especially as 5G grows, it'll be essential that the mobile industry receives more space on the spectrum.
The fastest growing home broadband company is a wireless provider, and 5G home will be key in closing the digital divide. We also know that the job is not complete. 5G goes further and faster every day. We need to keep building in New Mexico, South Dakota, and across the nation. This is about opportunity and equity. To do all of this, we need your help, and we need more spectrum.
Harold, everybody wants and needs more spectrum. Do they deserve it?
Well, I mean, it's sort of funny because we're in the middle of trying to formulate a new national spectrum strategy, the NTIA, which is the executive branch agency that manages federal use of spectrum, had a listening session here in Washington, D.C. Last week, and it was basically 30 different companies getting up there and saying, hi, this is why I'm important. Please give me more spectrum. Thank you. So, yeah, everybody wants it. And everybody's right in the sense that we all rely on it. We are getting more and more innovative uses out of it. The problem is it's not something that you can go manufacture more of or, you know, dig out of a mine or anything. So, but there are ways to think around this kind of zero-sum game, your loss is my gain kind of thing. One of the things, you know, and I think my boss, Chris Lewis, testified at that same August hearing that Meredith Baker testified at. And we, you know, one of the things that we talk about is different ways of sharing the spectrum, different ways to make federal users more efficient. There's a long lead time in it, but part of this is if Congress were willing to invest and spend more money to upgrade federal equipment, you could make federal users more efficient. They could do more with less spectrum. So you'd have more spectrum be available for other commercial uses. But it's hard. Nobody is thinking about cooperating. Everybody's thinking about, you know, I need some, and you're the guys who have it, so give it to me.
This seems to be a recurrent theme when we talk about why certain systems in the United States have difficulty really making major strides forward, a lack of a cohesive vision, a lack of standards, and a lack of cooperation. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes, Harold. But also, when those companies, right, when the telecom companies get up there and they stand up and say, hello, I need more spectrum, I think a fair response from lawmakers and especially, you know, citizens and customers is, okay, that's great, but are you at this moment actually providing the level of service that you say you are? So let's take a close look at that because, as you know, Harold, back in 2018, the FCC looked at ways to expand mobile coverage across the country and particularly in rural areas. That's comes up over and over again. And to measure where the needs actually were, the FCC first asked Verizon and AT&T and the like to submit maps to the FCC of where the companies claimed people had coverage.
Well, let me just say this. You show that map that shows coverage to anyone on the street in Vermont, and they'll giggle. Like, I mean, you've got to be kidding me. But no one seriously believes that that map actually purports to where there's actual service.
So this is Corey Chase. He's the telecommunications infrastructure specialist for the Vermont Department of Public Service. So the FCC also made another challenge when they asked for those maps. The regulator asked states to provide data that checked the accuracy of those coverage maps. And Corey said, game on.
So I got six phones, one for each of the companies that offer a service in the state. We searched and found a smartphone application that wasn't user-friendly, but would produce the test results that met the requirements that the FCC set forth, and started driving. And over about 2 months, we drove all of the significant roads in the state that ended up being about 6,000 miles of driving.
That's 6,000 miles of driving in Vermont, and he did it over 6 weeks. And after all of that, Corey says that the giggling Vermonters he had mentioned before, the ones who say, you've got to be kidding me, well, they were right, because he found that the companies did not meet the speeds they had reported on those maps in about two-thirds of his tests. But then something else happened.
The maps produced by the companies And the challenges that we submitted were all kind of overwhelming. And the FCC had intended to make available a large grant program. They basically decided to scrap the program and come up with a new plan.
Now, that grant program was a $4.5 billion fund to help expand LTE service in rural areas. And as Corey said, the FCC scrapped that program. And he thinks it's because the FCC received significant challenges from many groups who said those carrier maps just weren't accurate and they needed better data. So in 2022, the FCC again asked companies and the states to provide new coverage data. But again, test drives in Vermont showed
8% of the buildings in the state that are in areas that we tested, voice calls did not go through for AT&T. And that represents about 25,000 buildings. So there are 25,000 buildings that we know of that can't access AT&T's mobile wireless service. And importantly, they can't call 911. If they or their relatives or friends were over at their house, you know, it's a public safety problem.
So in this year's budget, Vermont Governor Phil Scott included a $10 million request to deploy new state-funded towers in underserved areas because of the length of time it's taken to get support from the federal level.
It is a frustrating thing for those of us who participate in the process. And we all want to avoid waste where possible with taxpayer money. But I think that our sense is that they veered so far the other direction this time is to make it essentially impossible to participate. As more and more people become more and more reliant on it as a part of our daily lives, when most of us live in areas that are urban and have access to service and you just think that it's always going to be there, you don't realize that there are huge swaths of this country that don't have access to that service, and yet we've all come to rely on it and we expect it to be there. And the fact that it's not is a problem.
So that's Corey Chase. He's the telecommunications infrastructure specialist for the Vermont Department of Public Service. Okay, Harold. So this gets us to talking about, you know, what can we do to improve reliability? And there are many solutions here. There's not one magic bullet. But what about starting with standards? Like, are there federal standards that telecom companies have to meet that say at the very least, if you say you have a certain level of coverage in a certain spot in the country, you actually have to have it?
You know, I'm glad we got to a place where I can put on my consumer advocate hat and have a good rant, because this is something we've argued about a lot, and this has been a hobby horse of mine for many years, is no, we don't have standards at this point. States have not regulated these services, and when they've tried, the FCC has often preempted them from trying to regulate these services. The FCC generally does not have quality of service standards for mobile, and to the extent that they have things like what we call performance metrics or build-out requirements, where you're supposed to cover, X amount of the population or X amount of the geography, they don't check. The standard is, quote, substantial service, which just means if you can sometimes get a signal, you know, there, then you're meeting your obligation. And to make things worse, to the extent that the FCC collects things like outage data, which they do, they keep that confidential. We Public Knowledge and Consumer Reports have argued for years that at a minimum, the FCC ought to publish the reliability data so that consumers can vote with their feet and you see which network is more reliable. And, you know, that's how competition is supposed to work. The FCC
What's preventing them from doing that? I'm hearing words lobbying bounce around in my head, but I don't want to presume.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the companies say, well, you know, that's trade secret stuff. And, you know, if you want us to report honestly, then you shouldn't you shouldn't publish it. To which, you know, our response is, first of all, an outage isn't a trade secret. You know, everybody in the area knows that their service isn't, you know, what you're doing is just making it harder for people to actually look at all of the information. You know, we've got, as you said at the beginning of the show, private websites that will keep track of this. But, we don't have anything official out of the FCC. We won't report honestly, you know, if it's not confidential. Like, it's a federal crime to lie about this stuff to the agency. You know, you're obligated to report honestly. So, you know, we have pushed very hard on this, but it's something that the companies have pushed very hard back on, and that, the commission just has not been willing to do yet.
I can only laugh, Harold. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't laugh because it's not funny, but it's ridiculous. I mean,
it is ridiculous. It just, excuse me. That's my bile rising in my consumer advocate throat there. Because it's insane, you know, and there's no good reason to not at least publish the reliability data so I could look at it on a yearly basis and say, well, I noticed that, you know, T-Mobile was more reliable than AT&T, or Verizon was more reliable than AT&T. Well, most everybody's more reliable. But anyway, and then I'll switch if I care about the reliability, you know, but
I mean, that should be like for every free marketeer out there, this should be an easy win. You know, like that's how the markets are supposed to work. With good information, people vote with their feet. And ideally, that makes a system. Well, they vote with their wallets, I should say, and that makes the system better. But I don't know. I'm hearing the words regulatory capture also bounce around in my head.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I have a lot of respect for folks at the FCC. I think a lot of times they're trying to do the right thing. But, you know, the problem is if they if they do their job too well and regulate too hard, Congress calls them in and has these hearings where they shout at them a lot. There was a famous moment when Tom Wheeler, who was the chair of the FCC in the second part of the Obama administration, was at an appropriations hearing. And this is when Republicans were controlling both chambers. I can't remember if this was in the Senate or the House, but the chair of the committee said, "For years, we've been cutting your budget because we want you to do less with less." So, if you're the agency, you're kind of reluctant to do stuff that the entire industry hates.
Okay. We literally have 30 seconds, and I'm so sorry for this, Harold. But what's the other one thing that you would want to change to help, get the networks to be more reliable?
Hold the companies responsible. Tell them it is their ultimate responsibility to make sure that the networks are running properly, have real penalties for when they fail to do that, because they're contracting with these guys. They can put these clauses in contracts, you know, that you're going to have to indemnify us if the FCC finds us and it's your fault. No more of this finger pointing and shrugging about how the network's so complicated. You're selling the service to the customer. You're in charge. You're responsible. Make sure it works. And if it breaks, fix it fast.
Well, Harold Feld, he's Senior Vice President for Public Knowledge, a consumer advocacy organization, and he's on the FCC's Security, Reliability, and Interoperability Council. Harold, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is On Point.